in the Pattern Podcast. Make left traffic, clear for the option.
Minneapolis departure, Archer 641, Charlie 2000, climbing 3000.
Line up and wait, 7 range, 4 Mike Alpha.
Marcel 172, Romeo Hotel, hold short on 133, ready to take off.
Albert Delta, about 3-2-1, Mike, enemy downwind for runway 25.
I'm John.
I'm Chris.
I'm Brad.
And I'm Mark.
And we are the In the Pattern Podcast.
Good evening and welcome to episode 25 of the In the Pattern Podcast. Thanks a lot for joining us this evening. I am your host, Chris, and along with me is John Conway, Brad Kane, and we do have a special guest tonight. The one, the only, Mr. Jason Shepherd. How's everybody doing tonight?
Hey, how's it going? Pretty good.
Awesome.
Very good, very good. Yeah, things are going good. I'm glad to get episode 25 underway, and maybe we can make this a little more regular. We're trying so hard. But anyways, yeah, we got a special guest, Jason Shepherd, on tonight. Glad to have you with us, Jason.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to see you down at Oshkosh, or I should say up at Oshkosh for us, huh?
Exactly. For me, it was up at Oshkosh and already planning AOPA and the Aviation Summit and everything else.
Ah, that's actually something that I was going to bring up, the AOPA Summit in Palm Springs. I know a lot of people from here is planning on making the trip over there. It's not far from Phoenix. I don't think it's more than a couple-hour flight at best. So I am on the cusp. I think I'm going to go. Just got to work out I don't know if I'm going to stay the night or travel back the same day.
Listen, if I'm traveling all the way from Florida, though, I think you can at least make the effort to at least drive the 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah, it's not even a bad drive. That's for sure.
So there's nothing stopping.
But I'll probably split the plane cost and hop down there with somebody. I don't know.
You come out and pick me up.
Just a matter of that might be a little counterproductive.
Not for me.
hitting the East Coast before you hit the West Coast. Yeah. So yeah, if you want to help pay for the fuel rate of me getting there and back, that's fantastic.
Yeah, not an option.
No, yeah. Look at.
No, you're a private pilot. You have to pay the price to get there.
I only have to. I can pay my half, my pro rata share.
Only on the way back.
Oh, that's true.
True.
Jason, is it time for me? Do I have time to knock out my commercial rating before then?
You know, I think so, and then you might be profitable. I'll just mail you whatever endorsements you need, okay? And then we'll just square up later, okay?
You need the instrument, though, right? Because the commercial without the instrument, you're only good for 50 nautical miles.
50 nautical miles from your home base. He'll just have to keep changing his home base every 50 nautical miles across the country.
Perfect. That's true.
It's a gray area.
Logistical nightmare. Jeez. Well, hey, guys, great to get episode 25 underway here. We got a few things on the docket here left over from previous episodes that we didn't get to, some new things, and of course, our special guest, Jason. If you guys don't mind, I'd like to just start talking to Jason. The reason why we got him on here, and that's just basically because he's got a new product that looks really good. Called Runway Log, and Jason kind of showed me a little bit about that at Oshkosh, and I've checked out his video with the explanation of how it works, and I've even seen some of your I think it was Twitter updates or Facebook updates with when you post from it. So you want to go into it a little bit, Jason? Tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the whole idea spawned from when I was a young, you know, 16, 17-year-old kid learning to fly, you know, didn't have a care in the world. I ended up losing my logbook, which I didn't realize what a valuable resume and everything else, you know, that ends up being down the road. So I knew there were other logbook solutions out there at the time, but there was nothing catered to who I primarily work with, and you guys have seen it through M0A.com and such, is that student pilot or that private pilot or even instrument pilot, catering to these lower time guys to give them not only a reliable way to back up their logbook, but help to keep them current. You know, when on the iPad app or the iPhone or even Android app, you know, it's going to tell you, hey, Chris, your flight review is due in, you know, next month. It's time to get it scheduled. Or I saw, Chris, you posted on Facebook about now your night current again. Well, in the runway log, it would have sent you a text message or an email saying, hey, Chris, your night currency's expired or about to expire. Better go call your flight instructor, you know, so you can go out and do that sort of stuff or schedule the airplane so you can do that. So really neat stuff to kind of cover your butt as far as that goes. Another pain, you know, I commonly run into and you know, you guys are in flying clubs and aircraft owners know this too, talking to insurance. Well, how much time exactly do you have in a 172? And you're sitting here going, great, more math I have to do. You know, it's something that just does all that for you. So it's really cool stuff. It's more than just a great backup plan. It is really your mathematician and that nagging mother behind you to say, go schedule your flight review because you're going to forget. And the moment you get ramp checked, you're toast. So it's really cool. I mean, everything's moving so mobile nowadays, and I didn't want to cater, although I've been known to be an Apple fanboy. We made the Android app, too, to really open it up for everybody to have that opportunity. So whether, you know, no matter what tablet you're on, you're going to be covered. So just really neat stuff. And again, I don't want this to, you know, sound like a big promo or anything like that, but that's just, you know, what's recently happening in the world of M0A.com and what we're knocking out, and I appreciate you bringing it up.
Excellent. Yeah, it sounds like just kind of a no-brainer, making it so easy that you're not having to, you know, go back in your logbook and find out when was the last time I did this or when was the last time I did that. I like that because we all have enough things going on in our life to, you know, these helpful reminders is a nice thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll share one more thing with you. One of my dreams was to always wanted to get like every, and I can't imagine a pilot hasn't had this dream. I always wanted to get like every sectional chart in the United States and put it up on some wall after I realized how big that wall would have to be. You know, that dream was shot. And I always wanted to put little pins, you know, in every single airport I've been to. And obviously there's no wall in my house big enough to do that. So we actually integrated it with Google Maps and put those little pins in every airport you've been to and showing the route of flight. So like you saw me share on Facebook, you know, my public logbook, you can see all the airports I've been to, you know, out in your neck of the woods into Sedona and all that stuff. So it's kind of a cool way to say, man, this is, you know, this is where I've been. So it's just a neat little feature in there.
Yeah, that's a good one. Also, what about when you're taking pictures from your phone?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you guys, you know, I'm friends with most of you guys on Facebook, too, so I see them all the time. You're flying around, you snap a quick picture on the cell phone. It will tag that picture into that logbook entry. So next time you're scrolling through your logbook, you know, you click on that entry, it'll show all the pictures from that entry. So it's really, again, it's more than just a logbook would be the best way to really explain it.
That's pretty cool. The picture thing is definitely a good idea. So what kind of interfaces do you have for this? So yeah, I heard you say Android, and I guess I'm assuming iPhone. Do you have like a web interface too?
Yep, all Apple, all Android. It has a web interface as well. But I mean, we see it right now. Everything is going so mobile in aviation, which I love. I think it's awesome. I'm a huge you know, tech geek when it comes to that sort of stuff. So not only am I navigating with my iPad now, but when I get done with my flight, you know, I'm logging my flight on my iPad effectively. I mean, we even got it set up where your instructor can e-sign, just like you guys have seen the Square app.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just with their finger can e-sign any endorsements, any entries, and they just e-sign right onto there. So really cool stuff. All FAA approved, backed up every hour, you know, so it's really a safe, secure way to do it. And it's just really trying to stay ahead of that technology curve was the approach with this.
Cool.
Nice.
Sounds really neat.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. I signed up for it, but I actually I looked on the Play Store for Android, but I couldn't find it unless I wasn't looking with the right words.
They can't. That's
not
surprising.
I'll send you the direct link. So you're Android based. I'll send you the direct link so you can get it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not, and again, I'm all Apple-based, so I haven't had a chance to really dig into the Android marketplace or whatever it's even called now to help you find stuff. So I'll get you that direct link, though.
Cool. All right.
Yeah, cool, we'll definitely post that in the show notes, too.
Cool, man. Appreciate
we'll post,
that, guys.
We'll post both links, actually, iOS and Android, since I'm in the middle of both right now. So.
Right?
John is in mobile phone flux, as it were. You know?
Well, you know, the iOS announcement's next Wednesday, so, you know, who knows what I'll pre-order then.
Yeah. I kind of feel bad for those, for the iPhone users and then how they're changing the interface and stuff. And, you know, you already have these, like, five or six other devices that you might dock your phone into and chargers and whatnot, and then they decide to change that interface on you. And so now you got to buy a whole other, you know, pile of accessories, if you were. So.
It doesn't bother me any as long as 4Flight still runs, because I love that thing. But
yeah. Well, you don't have an iPhone right now, right?
No.
So you're not out a few $100 in accessories.
Well, no, I have a lot of stuff here. But what's the name of the app again? So I'm going to look it up.
The app is Runway Log.
Runway Log.
And you can look that up there. It should all be in there. And if not, I'll get you guys the direct link. It was literally the web interface came out first. The app was just recently approved, so that's pushing through. And so if you search for it, you should be able to pull it up. But if not, like I said, I'll get you that direct link because it's so new to the store itself.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be pulling up right now. But yeah, we'll definitely post that.
Cool, man.
Cool. So since you brought it up, I went out last night and did get Night Current. I hadn't flown Night since January 25th of 2011, and that was...
Wow.
So that's been a few days. And because it's been that long, I didn't want to go do it by myself, so I grabbed my CFI, and we went out. And I got to tell you, I was a little nervous at first, being away from night flying for so long. That I was a little bit nervous, but I did five stop and goes, and I greased the first four of them. I practically rolled on the wheels each time. But my instructor says, you know what, some of the best landings I'm ever a part of is when students are doing night landings because they're so focused.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that, Jason?
I've seen both ends of the spectrum when it comes to night landings. I've had students blow tires on me at night, and I've had students look around and say, are we on the ground yet? You know, of course they were just showing off at that point. There's both sides of the story. There's the people that are so focused that it could hinder them. And there's someone like yourself that you said, man, I'm just going to knock this thing out. You're paying attention to everything. But sometimes, that over-focus causes more of an anxiety issue, you know, which then causes you to misjudge, you know, when that ground's coming. Literally, I had a student blow a tire at about 11 o'clock at night. And if you've ever been to the Dunellen Airport, you don't go out there at 11 o'clock at night because all you hear is coyotes out there and everything else. So we're in the middle of the airport with a blown tire. And I'm just like power walking back to the hangar saying, no coyotes are going to get me. Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, my fifth and final landing was a little bit firm, but still, you know, a little firmer than average. But man, the first four were really nice. So it was good to get back up there and get that knocked out, because I want to take the family for kind of a night circuit around Central Phoenix, over top of the Phoenix Bravo, over top of Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport, and that's really good looking at night with all those lights and everything. So
how high does that Bravo go up?
Well, when you're transitioning, and I'm heading south through the transition, they'll have me at 4,500 feet.
Wow.
And then coming back, I'll be at 5,500.
Right. Okay. So when you said over the top, I thought you meant like over the top.
No, I'm sorry. Over the top of the airport. Yeah.
So you're inside the Bravo, or is it a corridor?
Yeah, I'm right in the middle of it.
Okay.
They have you transition over the ends of the runways.
Cool.
Yeah. So, I don't know. When you did that long trip and you went to California, did you transition the Bravo?
I'd have to look back at the runway log map, actually.
Or did you even get through Phoenix?
No, we went airports we hit in there. We hit Tucson, we hit Sedona, and I think that was it for our experience in your homeland, really.
Yeah, yeah.
We boogied on through. We crossed Death Valley, and that was scary enough for us. We said, we're getting out of this terrible place.
Yeah, I want to fly down to Death Valley. I want to. That's not all that far away, and do that Furnace Creek.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Actually, get to land and take off below sea level. That'll be kind of cool.
Yeah, I really want to make it out to where to out there, because it just looks like some really cool flying terrain. Scary as hell, but really cool.
I'll tell you, you really learn, and again, I'm coming from Florida, but I mean, you really learn how to be a pilot out there. Like when we first partaked on flying across America, I thought I was a good pilot until I got out in those mountains and stuff. I mean, and I say mountains, they're really not anything, you know, that big. We went pretty far to the south. But man, in a Cessna 150 with just 100 horsepower engine, trying to get up to, you know, 7,000 or 8,000 feet was a task. I mean, if we weren't flying at 6 a.m, we weren't going anywhere. And going through mountain passes and stuff, it's like driving on a road. You know, you stay to the right and hope everybody else knows they stay to their right. And it all works out, and the wind's whipping through there. I mean, it was, like you said, it was scary. It was a scary but cool experience flying through that stuff.
Yeah, it just looks... It just looks so interesting, because I mean, the highest point that I have out here is something like, I don't know, 4,000 some feet. So mountains here aren't really an issue. So I don't get to experience anything as crazy as low mountains being 7,000 feet.
Yep. Come to the upper Midwest where, you know, mountains are like 1,000 feet.
Well, that's the Eastern Shore of Maryland, so I got it all out here.
Which is 200 feet above normal ground level.
Our density altitude is usually around 4,000 feet.
Yeah, that's the tough part. I mean, forget about the mountains. The density altitude alone, I mean, you must have just done morning flights in your flight training. I mean, that's...
Yeah, the majority of the time, I'd be at the airport at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When I fly, majority of the time, we're going north, so I'm going to the mountains, and so like Flagstaff or Sedona or Prescott or whatever, you know, I'm around 7,000 feet, and you just don't stop looking for where could I possibly put this thing down, and none of it looks good.
Yeah.
I mean, once in a while you'll hit a mesa, you know, that you could put it down in, but for the most part it's jagged, it's nasty looking. So
yeah, let me ask you a quick question to mountain flying wise, and off topic if I know what you want to work into eventually here, show notes wise. But what do you carry as far as, you know, flying around? You know, and again, in Florida, we're so spoiled. We have a horse farm here. We have a great road here, a beach here. You know, I mean, if you had to ditch or something, I mean, do you carry anything with you, or does the flight school provide a little survival kit in the airplane? It's just stuff I've thought about here. I mean, we do limited stuff, but I mean, there's desolate, man.
Yeah, just in my flight bag alone, I have a plastic box that is a first aid kit that has a little bit of everything in it. I usually bring, and I should probably bring more, but two or three, you know, little personal bottles of water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always have a flashlight on me, but that's pretty much it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know some of these people, you know, will have everything from, you know, a small tent. And, you know, of course, it also depends on the season. In the wintertime, obviously, you know, you're going to be bundled up a little bit better than the summertime when you're practically, you know, you're just in shorts and a T-shirt. But really, that's pretty much the extent of it.
Interesting.
Yeah. There are a lot of airports, though, out here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the good thing is that you're never all that far away from an airport. I mean,
right.
not that you're going to be able to glide to one if you have an engine out, but I mean, you're probably going to be within radio contact of something, you know, for sure.
Cool.
So, yeah. And I love me some flight following. I don't hardly go anywhere that's more than, you know, unless I'm just doing local, I do flight following when I even do a 50 nautical mile trip up to Payson for breakfast.
Mm-hmm. So how,
just cause.
So how is the flight, the radar coverage out there with all the mountains and everything?
That's fine.
Okay.
You just, at 7,500 feet, you're usually good. And lower, just depending on where you're at. But 75 and above, you're in good shape.
And you're...
You say 7,500 feet like it's nothing.
That's what I was just about to comment on. I think my field elevation's 170 feet.
Yeah.
So what is your field elevation to put that 7,500 into perspective? Because I have never flown that high. I think I've been to 5,000 feet.
And that was a chore to get up there.
Deer Valley's 1,400.
Dang, you're still climbing.
Yeah, and like Payson that I've done a bunch of times is about 5,200 feet.
That's just crazy, yeah.
Flagstaff's a little bit more. I think that's around the 7,000 foot marker.
Dang.
Because I was flying out
7,014.
I was flying out of a field that was 21 feet. And then I reached 5,000 at one point, and it took me a while to get up there. So,
yeah, I do spend a lot of gas climbing, that's for sure. But even if I go south, at some point I have to clear mountains. I remember one time I was doing a long cross country, and I had Luke Air Force Base on with me as my flight following, and he's like, okay, you're cleared to climb whenever you want. And I'm like, okay, thanks. And I just stayed where I was. It was real, real, real hazy out. And I just cruised along. And he told me that again. I said, okay, all right, thanks. And then soon enough, I start noticing there are mountains ahead of me. But there was so much haze out that I couldn't see them yet. So I was like, oh, that's why he told me I could climb.
Have you ever had flight following assign you an altitude?
No. I don't think so.
I've had that a few times when I've been flying around underneath the Minneapolis Bravo, and they'll give me a course and an altitude, and I'm going, wait a minute, I'm not in the Bravo, and I'm not on an IFR flight plan. What is this about? But, yeah, you comply.
Yeah.
I mean, why not? It's traffic avoidance.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's probably traffic on an IFR flight plan, maybe, that would have possibly came within a mile of you or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure it's to avoid having to reroute the IFR traffic, but it was unusual. I've had it happen a few times this year.
Well, speaking of feet and stuff, and distances, it made me remember that. Last night, Deer Valley's got two parallel runways. One of them's, almost 8,200 feet. That's the one everyone likes to take off of. It's longer and wider, but it closes at 8:30, right as the time that everyone who's doing night flying gets up in the air, and then you're using the shorter runway, which is, I don't know, it's about 4,000 feet or something like that, 4,500. So it feels tiny in comparison to the 8,200 foot runway, but so the shorter runway is the one that we're doing the stop and goes on, and my instructor's like, you know, if we have to, we'll just have to stop and taxi back, but I made them all stop and goes, and we were just doing short field takeoffs for the departures portion of it, and everything worked out really good. I was really happy with it, and I'm glad to have it done, and looking forward to the cooler evenings. I mean, we were up, it was flying between 8:30 and 9:30, and we're still sweating inside the airplane.
Oh man!
So, what else we got? Lots of stuff.
I tell you what, I want to hear about, Brad. How's that complex going? Since we're on the topic of climbing and 150's not getting up there very fast. How's the arrow?
The Aero does a little bit better. It's kind of a pig. but I did finish off the complex endorsement. I banged out my final 2 hours. I just grabbed an instructor, and we flew up to Duluth and back, and that gave me enough hours to get them to sign me off and to get enough hours to make the insurance company happy to let me solo the Aero.
Excellent.
Because
Was that just complex, or was that horsepower too?
That's just complex. It's a 200 horsepower, so it doesn't qualify for high performance.
What, and so how many hours were they happy with for you for doing that?
The insurance company wanted 10.
Yeah, that's what I think seems to be almost the de facto standard. Jason, what do you think?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, I have a student who's working on his high performance at 182. It's 10 hours. You know, for some people, do they need the 10 hours? No. But for some people, do they need 40 hours in the airplane? Absolutely. You know, so it really depends on the person. But yeah, 10 is the standard. You know, Brad, I can imagine, is a pretty competent pilot, so that's not a problem. But I've worked with some people before. They think they have their 10 and they're good to go. And I'm thinking, well, I hate to break it to you, but I'm not signing you off at 10 hours. You know, but yeah, that's usually a pretty standard.
Yeah, I think if I had been coming at it cold, it would have been a very different story. But I've been doing a lot of flying this year, and so you know, between getting the instrument rating and just other $100 hamburger runs and that kind of thing, I'm confident enough in the airplane to begin with that adding the prop and the gear wasn't too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
They did the instructor did the obligatory, you know, get me to look over someplace while he pulls out one of the gear lights. That was interesting. The other interesting thing on that flight was shut off the master, which I had never done before in an airplane. I'd never shut off the entire electrical system before.
Mm-hmm. Really?
And so, you know, we're going to do a gear emergency gear extension, which in an Aero, the gear is held up by the gear is brought up and down by a hydraulic pump that's electrically operated, and it's held in place by the hydraulic fluid. So the only thing that you have to do to drop the gear is either activate the pump, or if there's no electrical, there's an emergency gear extension, which just releases the pressure in the fluid and allows the gear to fall, and the gear will just fall into position.
And then lock.
And lock. And so we demonstrated that by shutting off the master, which I'd never done before, and I'm like, huh, tachometer doesn't work without electrical power. That's interesting. I would not have guessed that in a million years. I would have assumed that was a mechanical tachometer.
I would think it was a cable, a mechanical cable that spun in there or something.
Yeah, the manifold pressure shut off, the tachometer shut off, a bunch of things that I was not expecting to have happen.
Didn't you know that's how you save money on your flight training, that bills by the Hobbs and the tachometer? You just turn that off, right?
Oh,
secret.
I am so glad we had you on today, Jason.
You know, I'm full of insightful stuff, you know.
Well, and since the flying club bills by tack time, you know, and it's a complex airplane, I can pull, I can, you know, leave the manifold pressure up, but pull the prop back far enough that I'm at 2000 RPM or 1800 RPM or something, and get it that way.
Yeah, I don't know if it works like that, but sure.
Oh no, it works like that. I'm billed based on the fraction of full engine power hours.
Well, they do bill you on tack. They don't bill you on Hobbs.
There is no Hobbs meter.
Wow, interesting. So as long as you baby that engine, you're saving yourself money.
Yep.
Absolutely. That's cool.
Cool.
So that's one way I saved a lot of money on my IFR was I flew at 90 knots.
It's one way to do it.
Instrument, yeah, it's easier, slower anyways.
Exactly.
That's cool.
Exactly. So yeah, I banged out the complex, done a little bit of flying with it, did a $100 hamburger run with Aiden, and was coming back, and the weather started to come in. And we got out ahead of some scattered thunderstorms, well ahead of some scattered thunderstorms, but I knew that they were going to be moving into the area. And on the way back, they were about 20, 25 miles west of the airport. And I had to make a lot of decisions about what is my out going to be. You know, I don't want to get close to this thunderstorm at all. Where am I going to go? How am I going to explain to my wife if she has to drive out to some remote town to come and pick them up, so that I can spend the time with the airplane waiting for the weather to go by and fly it the rest of the way back to the airport. But it turned out that the thunderstorm stalled and just parked on a town about 20, 25 miles west of us, and I was able to get in. But that was the first time I'd ever had the ATC tell the plane in front of me to keep his speed up because of me coming in at 130 knots.
Oh.
Nice.
Big time.
Nice.
I'm always on the receiving end of that usually. It's, you know, hey, keep your speed up because there's a Lear behind you.
Right.
But yeah, that was a first for me, and it was an exciting flight. More exciting than I would usually care for, but you know, yeah. It was okay. It was VFR and I had a lot of outs. But it kept me very much on my toes.
Cool.
So that's it on the complex side.
So speaking of complex, I think that might be my next adventure. When I was talking with my instructor Jackie last night, she was telling me about we were talking about this other school where I went and got checked out in that 172 a while back, and we were talking about that, and she told me that they have a 182 RG down there now.
Nice airplane.
Yeah, and it's got 230 horsepower. Actually, it's got more than that. That's what it's rated at, but it's been polished and ported or whatever, so it's actually probably got a little more than that. But $149 wet for a 182 RG, and this thing will get up and boogie at like 150, 160 knots sometimes.
That's not bad at all. I mean, I was renting a one.
No, that's really.
I was renting a 172 SP for 145. So,
yeah, they can't be making a lot of money on that.
No,
I mean, that's cheap.
Yeah, well, you know that other plane I rent, Jason's 95 wet for a 172P.
You know, I think we had this conversation at Oshkosh. You're right. I mean, I don't understand why it's so cheap out there. I mean, that's ridiculous. There's no way. I mean, I know what I spend in maintenance for a silly 150. I can't imagine what not only a 182 but a 182 RG is. You know, maintenance wise.
Yeah, they're with that gear. They're pretty expensive.
They're hogs.
How much is gas out there, Chris?
I just flew last night and I paid. I got my receipt right here, in fact. 7 gallons. Let's see, 564 a gallon.
So pretty typical. So they're somehow making the difference in the maintenance cost of the airplane.
Do they have their own maintenance guy or something?
What's that?
I said,
go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
Did they have their own maintenance guy or something?
That works for the school?
Yeah.
Not as far as I know. Because what it is all of these airplanes, none of them are owned by the school. They're all owned by individuals who just allow the school to use them, you know, lease them back to the school. Because they've had other airplanes, like the first SP that I flew, they don't have anymore. The owner took it back and went somewhere with it. They get different airplanes from time to time. They still have two 172s, and then they got this 182, and they've got a Duchess. And I think the Duchess is leaving pretty soon. But Jason, so in a plane like this that's both complex and has the high horsepower, I'd be knocking out both of those endorsements at the same time. And would it still be just a total of 10 hours, or would it be 20?
Yeah, no, it would still fall under the 10. You know, that it's just going to be a little more airplane. Most of your time's low wing or high wing?
Most of my time has been low wing, and recently mostly high wing.
Okay, you shouldn't have too much of a problem with it. The 182 RG almost lands like a low-wing airplane. The one thing that's going to be different, Brad was talking about in the aero with the gear. Well, if you have a gear problem, you release the pressure, like you said, and the wheels just magically fall down. Magically gravity takes over. But with the RG, I did my commercial in a 172 RG, you have to pump the gear down. And I think and it varies from airplane to airplane. One of them, it was like 60 pumps. It's like an emergency brake in a car. So it was 60 pumps down. And I'll never forget my instructor. We were on the downwind, just came abeam the numbers, and he pulled the power back to idle, said the engine quit and the gear failed. So here I am, and Brad, you know this too, in the aero, if you're simulating an engine failure, you better start turning towards that point because that thing's falling out of the sky.
Yeah, it glides like a rock.
You're exactly right. I mean, that RG, the 172 RG I flew is the same way. So I'm diving towards the numbers and going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, trying to pump this thing down.
Getting a workout.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was, I mean, you talk about sweating, you know, in the desert now. Wait till you're having to pump that thing down 60 times. Your right arm, your right shoulder is going to be like ripped, you know? So, but yeah, the 10 hours, it's a real fun airplane, man. There's something exciting, and Brad can attest this too, that when you're on the upwind and you're out of usable runway and you put that gear up, you literally feel that airplane speed up 10, 15 knots. And the same thing, when you put that gear down, you feel you slide forward in your seat just from all that drag. I mean, it's a cool feeling.
I'm excited. I really want to go do that here pretty soon. And it just, you know, it gives you that extra legs. I mean, for with doing that extra speed, you know, grabbing an extra maybe 40 knots, Now I've got a whole bunch of different airports that I can make it to within that same, like, hour time frame, right? I just increased my distance on my cross-country flights because I can get there so much faster, so.
Is it turbo?
No, not as far as I know.
Okay. That'll still be cool regardless, but just wondering, especially out there at density altitude, that'd be really sweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
So that'd be pretty cool. Yeah.
So one day I'll catch up to you guys when I buy my own complex airplane. One day.
Yeah, get that bonanza.
Me and my friend have been talking a lot lately about what we can do in the next 2-3 years, what we could buy. And I actually, you know, talking to Damon on the way back from Oshkosh, he was looking on Tradeplane while we were driving, which was an awful idea because then we started talking about how we could make this actually happen. We found a Citabria for 28. It was a 1980 Citabria for 28K with relatively low time. Inverted, you know, everything. I mean, it was awesome. Now, the insurance on that would be awful for a 100-hour pilot with brand new tailwheel and all that kind of stuff, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are fun planes. I keep looking at those myself. Seems like... My mission for what I want in an airplane, I actually want two different airplanes to complete that mission because I want something like the Citabria, but then I want something else that will do four people, you know. So.
And I agree with that, but you know what I was thinking about and thinking about this a lot lately is, you know, if I can get a Citabria for 28, okay, I split that with somebody, that's Sam, you know what, 14, right? So 14 each just in buying the plane. Then you got maintenance and all that other kind of stuff. But I mean, the thing uses like 6 gallons an hour. So when you put the cost into it, it's a great plane to just build time. And what do I need to do right now? You know, I need to build time, but I want to have fun doing it. So it's the perfect plane to build time and to have fun doing it and to be able to go out, get some instruction and do, you know, unusual attitudes, get some spin training, get some aerobatics and just start becoming a better pilot so that, you know, I can build all this time. And then eventually when I want to go and I can actually afford to get a nice 4-6 seater aircraft, I've got experience that number one is going to even lower my insurance even more when I go to that next step. But then, you know, I'm building a lot of time and having fun doing it. So I think that something like that is kind of perfect for what I want to do right now and what I can do right now until I can afford to get the plane that I want to do to take me places. And then at that point,
no doubt about it, it's perfect for time building. Plus, tailwheels are just fun.
Yeah. So by that point, by the time you know I'm done with the Citabria, either or I'm ready to get a 4-seater, 6-seater plane, whatever, I'll either have enough money to keep the Citabria, or I'll have the Sonics done, and I'm golden. Two planes. There we go. It's sold.
Yep.
But Tradeplane is just such a bad place to go.
Yeah, I spend a little bit too much time on there and controller and barnstormers.
Yeah, it's just
Jason. Do you still window shop?
Every single day. I mean, and I'm looking at everything from another Cessna 150 to Citation Mustangs. I'm like, you got to dream big, you know? I mean, gosh darn it, why not? So, yeah, I mean, and I'll tell you, I mean, the best thing you can do is own an airplane. I mean, you want to build time and do all that stuff. I mean, that's the best thing you can do. I mean, everything is so cheap right now. An airplane really is an asset. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise, because you'll end up on the positive end of it, you know, assuming you don't have any big, giant, you know, maintenance headaches. You know, it really is a good investment to do that. I mean, and if you can do it with a partner, even better, as long as you guys are going to get along with everything. And even don't forget about looking into clubs and stuff like that, too. I mean, you guys are involved in the club and have had success with it. I mean, there's a lot of that in there, too. And you effectively have a little bit of stake in that game, too, from a financial and an asset in the portfolio kind of standpoint.
Yeah, I do wish that the club situation here was a little better, because that's one of the things that I think would be more manageable for me right now. Club's probably the best bet, because it's a lower buy-in, it's less cost overall. You're sharing a lot more of the maintenance cost with a bunch of people. The problem is the club I'm in is 300 people, and we're down 3 planes from the big storm we had back in July still. So there's only one 172 that I can fly right now, and I can't get it because it's such a high value for. All these people are trying to get it. I can't schedule a plane, and I'm about to go out of currency probably within the next week, which sucks. But, like, I'd rather be in something that's, like, you know, 15, 20 people with one or two planes. But they just don't have that around here because of the DC stuff. So,
yeah, that's hard.
So what is – so speaking of currency, so what is their rule on currency for renting there then?
So my rule on currency right now, because I'm under 200 hours, is I have to go up once every 60 days. I have to do a minimum of 1 hour and a minimum of 3 takeoffs and landings. So they add in the minimum of 1 hour, and then they subtract the 30 days from what it normally is. Once I'm over 200 hours, then it's a normal 90-day currency, and I think still 1 hour, but that's about it. The other stipulation that I understand, but it's kind of a pain a little bit, is that you have to have a clearing authority clear you before every flight if you're under 200 hours. So before I can check out a plane, I actually have to speak with another instructor somewhere, either my instructor or somebody at the flight school, and be like, hey, is it cool if I go fly? Because here I got the weather, it says this kind of thing, but I have to get cleared before I can do it.
Wow.
Yeah. What's kind of a pain with that is sometimes it's hard to get an instructor. Because if I want to fly at 7 in the morning, well, who am I going to call at 7 in the morning? And
yeah, there's all these logistical hoops you got to jump through.
Well, the problem is, last time when I flew, I took my coworker up. What happened is it's 8 o'clock in the morning. My instructor isn't answering her phone. Turns out she was actually on a flight. And the guy who's a clearing authority who works the desk doesn't come in until 9. So I'm sitting there with the CFI list. I started calling down the list. I got one guy, and he's like, you want what now? He's like, I've never had this happen before. He's like, nobody's ever just called me out of the blue. He's like, I don't know you. You're not my student. How do I know? He's like, I don't know. So it's kind of a hassle, but.
Yeah. It seems a little over the top. But, you know, when you're kind of faced with, you know, here's your options and you don't got many to choose from, you know, what do you do?
I wonder if that's just because of the complicated airspace and all the NOTAM, you know, all the VIP NOTAM or TFRs.
I think it's actually more about the weather than anything, than it is TFR and the complicated airspace. I think it's just they're a little, you know, with the insurance. And they've got a lot of people. And I think what happened is they got burned a lot by people who just weren't taking care, weren't paying attention.
Wow.
And I mean, it's a club of 300 members. That's also associated with the government. So you end up having the government oversight as well, which is another thing, because actually it's technically part of the Air Force. It gets brought down from the Air Force. So a lot of this is actually coming because it's an Air Force club, in a way. So you get a lot of weird rules that get kind of passed down through all of that kind of bureaucratic stuff that happens. So, It's a weird bit, but the problem is that it's the cheapest flying around. You cannot find any 172 in the area for less than $100, less than 120 even, except here I'm paying $95 an hour to fly a 172P. So the price is just something I can't beat. So for me to fly at all right now, you know, I got to stay there until I can find or buy something of my own, which isn't going to happen because I'm getting married. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Let's move on because I know, John, you're getting a little short on time here. I wanted to hit up Brad about the Mooney that we were talking about previously. How's that going?
Yeah, I started doing a little bit of transition. Our club bought a Mooney M20J, and it's a wonderful plane. It's got a really nice panel. It's in great condition, nice leather interior, all that good stuff. But it's I just came off my complex. I just came off an IFR. I'm pretty, you know, recent in terms of getting a lot of time in and everything, and I'd love to get the additional speed boost because it is, you know, similar to that 182RG performance-wise. It's, you know, 160 knots true airspeed up around 7,000-8,000 feet on about 10 gallons an hour. But it's got a lot of different electronics in it, and we did an electronics briefing, an avionics briefing the other night, and I went down to the club and attended to that, and it was very eye-opening just how different those systems are. You know, everything from, you know, the gear is electric gear with an electric motor. I haven't read the emergency gear procedure, so I don't know how it is that you get the gear down if there's an emergency. Electric flaps. And I'm used to flying all Cherokees, then all have a big bar on them that you lift up to extend the flaps. So I don't think about, you know, if I lose power, what's going to happen to the flaps. The yeah. Autopilot has two autopilots, one that is a roll axis autopilot and the other that is a totally separate autopilot for pitch. And the button on the yoke to disengage the autopilot only disengages the pitch one. So if you want to disengage the roll axis autopilot, you have to reach over and hit a button on the panel. Just a lot of little things like that that you wouldn't necessarily expect. But it can fly a coupled approach, a two-axis coupled approach to an ILS. It can do all of this stuff, but it's complicated. The ground checkout procedure for the pitch axis autopilot is 45 steps. That's a lot of time.
45 steps for pitch axis?
For pitch axis, to do the, you know, sort of the run up time checkout of the autopilot.
That's a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the thing has four buttons on it.
I guess some of them you have to push more than once, huh?
Well, and it doesn't, another unusual thing, it doesn't do the trim. Most pitch axis autopilots just fly the trim wheel and they just adjust the trim up and down and you leave the yoke wherever it is and they'll just adjust the trim to either climb or descend or to maintain a particular altitude. This thing actually moves the yoke. So when you hit that button and disengage it, all of a sudden, if you're not holding on to the yoke tightly, the yoke's going to come flying backward or forward back to the neutral position because this thing's been holding it with however many pounds of force is necessary.
Weird.
So there's just a lot of weird little things like that. Like it has an HSI, which I love, but it's a fully electric HSI. There's no vacuum to spin the gyros at all. So if you, even though there is a backup... it has an alternate vacuum on it in case you lose the vacuum pump, but the only thing that's powered by the vacuum pump is the attitude indicator. But it's also slaved. It's a slaved HSI, which I've never worked with before either. So, okay, you turn it on and it hopefully adjusts itself to the correct heading.
The Archer you fly wasn't slaved?
No. Nope.
Okay. Maybe it's a newer thing. I don't know. The Archer I fly, it's slaved. So you don't have to adjust it for the compass.
Yeah, no, and I'm completely used to always kind of reaching up and adjusting the thing to the wet compass. You know, okay, so fine, you know, talk about that and just all these little subtle different things, which are probably just enough to get you in trouble if you're not really familiar enough with it. So, just learning that. I haven't set foot in it to turn the key yet, but, you know, sooner or later.
What are they going to have that rent at?
So we don't know what the mechanical price on it is going to be. So what they did is they took what it would cost you to fly, say, 100 miles in the Aero, and they applied that same ratio to the Mooney. So it'll cost you the same to go a given distance, even though in the Mooney you'd do it in less time. Mm-hmm. So the hourly rate on the Mooney is higher until we figure out what it actually is going to cost.
I get you. Cool. That's what were you going to say, Jason?
I was just agreeing with him.
Oh, okay. I was when I was flying last night with Jackie. One of the things I mentioned to her was the autopilot inside the Archer. I don't know. I guess it's a three axis. What is it? It's an S-Tech 55X. I know how to turn it on, and I can have it follow the heading bug, or I can have it follow lock in for the nav for the VOR. But I don't know how to set up. There's another display that you turn on to put in like your altitude. It's a little digital thing, and I know it does something else, but I don't know. So I told her sometimes when it cools off, I want to grab her and go out for an hour or two and go teach me all the whiz bang features about the S-Tech 55, so I can learn how to use the autopilot as well.
I'm looking online, and it looks like it's a two-axis autopilot.
The S-Tech 55X?
Yeah.
Because it does. Well, I guess pitch and roll is just two axis.
Yep.
It would be pitch, roll, and altitude capture is what you would really call it. Altitude capture is not another axis. So it's still controlling your pitch, and it's just going to capture that altitude is how it would probably be worded.
Okay. All right. That's that other little digital device that I've never turned on, I guess.
Right.
So. So I don't know if that works by adjusting the trim wheel like you were talking about, Brad, or not. So we'll see. I'll report back on that whenever I get that done.
Yeah, it's subtle little things like that that really make a difference. That you really want to know how that stuff works so that when stuff's happening, you're not surprised by a distraction in the cockpit of, hey, why is the plane suddenly violently pitching up?
Yeah, yeah. We're running low on our allotted time, it seems.
Jack Hodgson has everybody saying that now.
Yeah, yeah. That's his line, isn't it? Anyone else have anything they wanted to go over real quick? I have several other things that I could spew into for a while, but we can, of course, leave them for next time.
Hey, I had my first wildlife strike.
Really?
Say again?
I had my first ever wildlife strike.
Oh, no.
Beetle, bug?
Other than a bug.
Oh, other than a bug.
We hit a bat.
Oh.
A bat.
This wasn't the same bat.
The bat went flat.
This wasn't the same bat that clung onto the external tank of the space shuttle, was it?
No, I hope not. I was pushing the plane back in, and I'm like, huh, that looks like some weeds or something over on the wing, but it was night, and so I couldn't see very well, and got it in the hangar under the lights, and I went, oh, that's kind of disgusting. There's this big, remains, messy bits of a bat attached to the wing, just spread out right across the leading edge, and I'm thinking, do I have to report this? Do I have to send this thing to the Smithsonian?
You have to put it in a Ziploc bag and mail it to the NTSB.
No, it's the Smithsonian that does the...
Oh, yeah.
Does the identification.
Because they want to know the species. Yeah.
So I get on my handheld and I call the ground control and I say, yeah, so I hit a bat. Do I have to do anything? And they're like, And you can almost hear the guy look over at the tower supervisor, and the tower supervisor silently shakes his head, and he comes back on and says, "No, you're fine." I did fill out the form online anyway, though, just to say I have.
The consummate rule follower.
Now you're in the system. Just wait to see what happens.
Hey, I've got an ASRS report and a wildlife
wait
strike.
Wait till they show up at your door, you know?
you're due for some paperwork now.
Yeah.
Oh, man. John, anything new else? Anything else new, I should say, going on?
Isaiah, not much. I mean, I had that currency thing back in May that I did, and then I flew again in July. But I just, honestly, I've been trying to get a plane here recently. I've had some issues due to just the amount of people trying to get the plane, like I said before. And I had my friend on watch trying to, he had some time schedule, and he said if he ends up not flying, he'll let me know. But I haven't heard anything yet, so... it's looking like I'm probably going to have to go back up with an instructor, but due to the fact that I'm moving this month and a bunch of other stuff, it may not be till October. But I'm looking forward to the winter because fewer people are going to be flying. It's going to be nicer weather, fall, winter. So, I'm kind of looking forward to it and hoping I can get up some more time in this fall. And, if not, once the wedding kind of clears out of the way a little bit, it'll be a little bit easier. So
I hear you.
Here's to hoping.
Jason, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, here's to hoping.
We'll be wishing you the best as the move goes and the plane situation eases up a little bit for you.
Hey, I will be getting room to be able to build a plane, so maybe I can start buying parts.
A big wooden box mailed to your doorstep with parts in it. Sounds like fun. Jason, when we were at Oshkosh, we were talking a little bit that you were shopping a little bit, looking around for another plane. Have you found anything that tickled your fancy a little bit and might make you pull out the checkbook?
Well, I'll tell you, I can't remember what our exact conversation was. I don't think this was in the conversation, though, but I just got back probably a week and a half ago from Missouri picking up a 182, 1962 182, real pretty. Just Ooh. Had a Garmin 430 put in it, going to pick it up tomorrow. And really just a nice get-up-and-go airplane for the wife and I. Actually partnered with a student on it. That's the one advantage of being a flight instructor. You meet all these great people and then, end up, working, deals with them and stuff. So just a pretty cool thing. We have some friends in the Baton Rouge, kind of New Orleans area. You know, it used to be a six-hour flight in the 150 or could take the 12-hour drive. Did it in the 182, not 3 hours. So really a good get-up-and-go airplane. Again, we put the 430 in it. I think every airplane should have at least a 430, and it's my rule of thumb now. I mean, everywhere has GPS approaches now. It's just really, again, staying ahead of that technology curve as to what's happening. So that's the latest thing. I know you and I spoke about another 150 and some other stuff. 1-2 Romeo, the famous video airplane, is down for the month. She's getting a new paint job and a brand new Continental O200 put in her. And we're actually going to make her the official M0A.com spokes airplane. And all she's going to do is videos. And I do a lot of work with like the kids and youth in aviation. So I'll fly them in it. And that's going to kind of be her role coming up here in the near future. So pretty cool stuff happening. New airplanes and facelifted airplanes. So that's kind of what we've been dealing with a lot lately.
Cool. I look forward to seeing that new paint job with some M0A swag on it.
Absolutely. It's going to be beautiful.
Yeah, the 182 is quite the SUV of the sky, man. You can haul whatever you want in that thing.
I'll tell you, though, the only thing I was disappointed with is when I pulled up to the fuel pumps, I'm used to spending $70 to fill up the 150, and I spent $170 to fill up the 182, and I'm like, darn, this stinks already. So
yeah, it's got quite a bit more horsepower.
Absolutely.
You got to pay somehow.
Exactly right.
Yep.
a couple of things I wanted to bring up real quick is that coming up here in Phoenix real soon, Luke Air Force Base is planning its first civilian fly-in since 9/11. And I really didn't realize they were doing them before then, but it's a pretty cool deal where they allow a certain number of pilots to fly in to the Air Force Base and hang out and do some different things. Like they do some tours while you're there and go over a bunch of safety briefings and whatnot. But you also get your chance at the controls of an F-16 sim. So that would be pretty cool. Unfortunately, it's seems to be on a Thursday and a Friday. So although I'm pretty sure I could have got the time off, I didn't send in for it. And it's only available to Arizona registered pilots flying from Arizona. So it would be a pretty cool deal. Get a chance at the F-16 simulator. Actually land on the Air Force base runway. That would be cool without getting in trouble for doing so. And they're doing it over 2 days. You had to put in your application by August 23rd, and then they're picking a certain amount, like 40 people to fly in, and a certain amount of people can drive in. 250 total people, participants, over the 2 days. So I know a bunch of people that put in for it, so hopefully some of them get a chance to go to it and maybe I'll even be able to tag along with one of them possibly, but I doubt it.
Real quick, too, and I know we're on a time crunch, but I wanted to share along the same lines. Here in Florida, they're not as far along as your situation is, but they're talking about it. The old shuttle landing strip, they're talking about doing something very similar with and allowing GA guys to go ahead and fly in there. I'm thinking, how cool would it be to land on the shuttle landing strip in, you know, Cape Canaveral? That would be awesome.
I'm in. Sign me up.
That would be great.
I just want to know how many touch and goes I can do while still on the upwind. It's like 16,000 feet long.
Oh, okay. That's what I was wondering. Was it like 12 or 14,000? 16,000.
You can get to traffic pattern altitude and land again.
Oh, that's
insane.
That
would be an experience. It'd be fun just to have in your logbook, right?
Yeah, it would.
It'd be good. Just doing tailwind landings on it would be great. Do a 30-knot tailwind landing.
Yeah. across the width of it instead of the length. and another interesting thing, I don't think I brought this up in previous ones, but prior to going to Oshkosh, I did a flight with a friend I met out here, and one of the cool things, I did mention this, didn't I? My dirt strip landing. Did I talk about that before?
Mm-mm.
No. Okay. There's on the way on one of the northern routes when you're like heading to Payson and places in the Northeast, you go over top of the Verde River. And it's not much of a river. It's more of a creek that you could probably jump across in most places. But there is some running water through it. And it's basically you can spot it from the air just about anywhere because it's the only strip of green that you see for a long time. But along the Verde River, there's this little bitty dirt strip. It's only 1,400 foot long. And it's called the Red Creek Strip. And I'm almost positive that it's not on any map. It's not charted because for whatever reason, I don't know, it's just too small. But it's perpendicular to the river, so you're typically flying upriver and then it's going to be off to the left of you. And anyways, we were heading up to a breakfast fly-in at the Mugion Rim, and he said we started talking about that dirt strip, and he asked me if I ever flew in there, and I said no, I've never been in there, I've heard about it. And he goes, well, we've got plenty of time. Let's go ahead and do it. So we overflew it and took a look at it, nice and slow, and no one had thrown any railroad logs out there to screw anybody up, and it looked dry and pretty clean. So we're like, let's go for it. So we headed downwind, kind of U-turned it, and came back, and he plopped that thing down on there, just pretty as can be, and had it stopped in no time. It was like he had done this like every day of his life. It was impressive because I'm absolutely certain that I couldn't do it. And the other thing about this is that there's only one way in and one way out, because if you have a missed approach, I don't think you're going to outclimb the terrain that's directly in front of you. Hopefully you can turn tight enough to make it out, but chances are you're not. It's like I said, it's only 1400 foot, and then there's just mountain in front of you after that. So you got to go down and then turn around and then take back off. So I got a video of it up on YouTube. It's pretty good.
Wow.
It was fun. I'd cool. never been on a dirt strip before. And everything out here is either paved or there is some dirt strips, and there's definitely no grass strips. So.
Yeah. Cool.
And then we headed on up to the Mugyan Rim for that breakfast fly-in, and then from there up to the White Mountain Lake, which is another one a little bit further north and east, for a second breakfast fly-in of the day, and headed back. And he was in a Cherokee too, by the way, just so kind of familiar with what kind of plane was in there. So, but anyways, we're running short on time, John. I know you got to get going, so. Shall we get to some shout-outs?
Yeah, definitely. I have one pretty much. Just a quick shout-out to a friend of mine, the one who keeps bugging me about buying an airplane with him. He's actually finally been bugging him for a while about this, but he has scheduled his check ride for his private on the 18th of September. So just a quick shout-out and good luck to him, and it's been a long time coming. I know he's been busy and had to keep pushing it back, and then problems with the club, but he's got it scheduled, so good luck to him.
All right.
Way to be.
Yeah. Brad, you got anything?
Just one for our guest. Shout out to Jason. I mentioned this to him at Oshkosh, but it pays probably to mention it on the podcast. One of the ways I saved a lot of money when I was doing my private pilot training was by taking advice that I found in one of Jason's videos from way back when about exactly that, how to save money on your private pilot's license. And if you haven't checked out Jason's videos on m0a.com, you definitely should. So there you go.
Appreciate that.
And I've got a couple. I think it was a week ago or maybe 2 weeks. Mike Daniels, also known as Mike Flies on Twitter, was down here doing some work, and so I hung out with him. We had dinner together over at Deer Valley Airport and closed the place down, hung out on top of the observation deck on top of the restaurant, and watched a bunch of planes doing stop and goes to get their night currency. So that kind of got me itching to do it, so I had to go out and do it. Yeah, Mike and I hung out for a little while and had dinner and watched some planes and just chit-chatted for a while. So it was good hanging out with you, Mike. And the other guy, Mark Maiden, from the Maiden Flight podcast. He's one of our listeners, and just wanted to give a shout-out to him. And he started his podcast not too long ago. I think he's through about 6 or 7 episodes now. Matter of fact, I think I just listened to his latest one just the other day on his he's on 8 episodes of his first solo, and that was exciting to hear and kind of brought back some memories. So congrats to Mark continued good luck on getting your ticket. All right,
before we wrap up here, let's Jason, I guess another shout out to your new endeavor there, where we can find it, all that kind of good stuff.
Absolutely. You can find everything about Runway Log on runwaylog.com, and also, like Brad was talking about, all those weekly flight training tips and flight training videos on m0a.com.
Cool. But yeah, everybody, definitely go ahead and check that out. We'll have all the links in the show notes. Thanks again for coming here and chatting with us today. It has been a blast.
An honor.
Appreciate that, Jason.
So with that, let's go ahead real quick and just where you can find us. Chris, we'll go ahead and start with you.
Sure. You can typically find me on Twitter, and the handle is CHOLUBAZ. That's CHOLUBAZ. That's also the same handle you'll find me on YouTube for the YouTube videos. And at chris@inthepatternpodcast.com.
Go for it, Brad. I know what you're going to say.
Well, then just put it in from one of the other episodes. You can find information on how to contact me at inthepatternpodcast.com. You can email me at brad@inthepatternpodcast.com, or you can find my Twitter handle there, and I'll spare you having to listen to me spell my name in the IKO alphabet.
Yeah, I'm lazy, so, you know, I'm not going to go to another podcast to do that. Finally, you can find me online at Pilot Conway on Twitter. I am John at InThePatternPodcast.com. I'm also Pilot Conway on My Transponder and Google Plus at John L. Conway the Fourth. With that, you can reach all of us at the podcast at podcast@InThePatternPodcast.com and our website at InThePatternPodcast.com. We're also on Twitter and Google Plus is InThePattern. Go ahead and give us a like on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/InThePatternPodcast. Go ahead and check out our homepage. We now have a new link for the mailing list that we have. If you want to stay updated, we're basically using that to just send you updates for the latest episodes. So if you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, go ahead and throw your email address on there. It's on the homepage on the right-hand side on inthepatternpodcast.com. And finally, go ahead and leave us a voicemail if you'd like. That number is 707-PCAST-01. That's 707-PAPA-CHARLIE-ALPHA-SIERRA-TANGO-01. And we look forward to hearing from you. And I guess with that, that's going to go ahead and wrap up this show, our 25th show of the In the Pattern podcast. I'd like to thank Jason again for coming on and joining us. It has been a blast. And with that, thank you all for listening. And remember, make left traffic. You're cleared for the option.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
TheVoicesInYourHead.com.
The members of the In the Pattern podcast are participating as private individuals. Their comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the various organizations they work with, the instructors they learn from, or the flight schools they attend. Remember, these guys are student pilots, so anything you hear on this podcast that sounds like advice on an aircraft operation is obviously from the perspective of student pilot. You should always consider your own situation, consult your instructor, remember your training, and fly the airplane. Cleared for the option.
Sorry, I'm completely losing my train of thought.
Hello, train.
I know, it's there, I swear. It's getting late. I'm not used to this. It's 10:30.
You know, I just realized that my information is not on InThePatternPodcast.com.